Hello, and welcome to another episode of Free Lunch by The Peak, the podcast where we talk to people way smarter than us about the most important topics in Canadian business, economics, and policy. I'm your co-host, Taylor Scollin.
And I'm Sarah Bartnicka.
So Sarah, I have to confess that, you know, we do write a business publication, but my first love and what I do nerd out on the most is politics.
Yes.
And I don't know if you know this, but there are a lot of elections happening this year.
The biggest election year in history, 2024 yes. is.
Yeah, some huge elections. I think it's, do you know the stat off the top of your head? Something like
half of the world's population, 4 billion people will be heading to the polls. We'll have the option to head to the polls.
Right. Some of them will not vote.
And not all elections are created equal, but we can also talk about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely true. So I thought it would be a good idea to dive into what some of those elections are, just get a broad strokes overview of, you know, who the players are, what the outcomes might be, and how those outcomes might impact us here in Canada.
Well, there's a lot of leadership switchovers that are happening. And anyone who's worked in any company imagining that much shakeup in any type of ecosystem while trying to get things done, especially with the to-do list that politicians have in front of them today, will be interesting for sure.
Yeah. And especially when you think about the American elections. And
that's the grand finale
of course,
of the year.
All of the trade issues that come with that. And I mean, God knows what's going to happen and what the implications might be, but it's surely, and it's a big deal for people here, you know, regardless of what you do, but especially if you're running a company or in a decision-making capacity at a company, like these things are going to impact you.
If there's a year to get into politics, you could make the argument that this is the year to start paying attention.
Yeah. And then maybe get right back out again.
Right.
If you're not into it.
Immediately.
But, we do have a great guest on to talk us through all of the big elections happening this year. Graham Thompson is a senior analyst of global macro geopolitics at the Eurasia Group, which, by the way, is a title that I would love to have someday. Senior analyst of global macro geopolitics. I love that. Anyway, Graham, thank you for joining us on Free Lunch.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so we're going to do sort of an overview of a bunch of different elections in different parts of the world today. And of course, we're going to spend a lot of time on the States. But I thought before we got into that discussion, why don't we start with a few of the other places where elections are happening? And maybe a good place to start would be India, because we have elections coming up there in the spring. India, obviously, I believe the world's largest democracy. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I believe that that's the case. And one with an interesting relationship with Canada, a complicated relationship. Obviously in the news a lot with the alleged assassination of the Sikh leader in British Columbia and the strained tensions between Prime Minister Trudeau and Modi over there. So, Graham, can you just give us an overview of what we should be expecting in India's election? Who are the players? What is the likely outcome? All that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. So, you're right to say that India is the world's largest democracy, and
good. Nice.
Always good to start with start on a good foot. Basically, we're looking at in 2024. There's been a lot of headlines about this being, you know, the year of elections. Something like 2/3 of the global population is voting, and that statistic obviously comes from adding up India and a couple other places I think we'll get to soon, which is the European Union and the United States, not to mention Indonesia just had an election. So if you take those four countries on, you know, European Union, not a country, but as a jurisdiction, you take them on their own, that gets you a really long way towards that 60%. So broad strokes in India, Narendra Modi has been really unchallenged as prime minister for he's led two parliaments. They're not, you know, as Canadians, we know that we're not talking about presidential administrations here. He's the prime minister. So he leads the majority party in the Indian parliament, which is the BJP, which is interesting because they first came to power under Modi. The sort of previous natural governing party of India was the Indian National Congress, which had governed more or less since independence from Britain in 1947. So for Modi coming in, this is a different mode and style and ideology of government than India had been used to in the past. he's coming up at an election that would be, if he wins, which is looking very likely, the BJP will have another parliamentary majority, would be his third term in office. And the Congress Party, which was previously sort of the natural governing party, is well back in the polls. And to the extent that those are reliable, and I think it's fair to say Modi is very popular in terms of public opinion. The BJP has got a great organization. Some people would point to that's being a bit soft on the ways in which they've sort of consolidated power in India and started to push a little bit on that free and fair democracy thing that India has been a leader on, especially in the global south. But broad strokes, Modi is looking to be cruising to a re-election later this year.
What's his plan for India? And given all the tensions over the last few months, do you think Canada plays a role in the country's future?
Well, it does play a role. There's obviously very close people-to-people ties between Canada and India. Indian international students are the major demographic coming to Canada. The Canadian pension funds, other investors are huge investors in India. And the trade relationship is substantial, despite the fact that there isn't a free trade agreement. It's just India is not as large as it could be if there was a free trade agreement, if relations were a bit better. But India is a huge economy, a huge population, with very close links to Canada. So it does matter. But from the Indian perspective, I think they're not all that worried about Canada. Modi's, if you want to think about it in terms of domestic politics and foreign policy, the two obviously come together. But my understanding of what Modi is trying to do in India these days is to set the economy on a longer term footing. He's focused on fiscal consolidation, especially after the pandemic, when a lot of governments ran up debt. India doesn't have the safety net that a lot of developed Western countries have. That was very costly. So they're trying to consolidate the fiscal position, rein in expenditures on debt, but also thinking more long-term in terms of, you know, simplifying a tax regime to encourage foreign and domestic investment. They are really looking to ramp up their infrastructure. You can think a little bit about the parable of the tortoise and the hare. China having been the hare for the last 20 years, just plowing money into infrastructure. And India, more slowly but surely, increasing its growth rate and becoming a bigger player, they still have a major infrastructure deficit. There's a lot of poverty in India. And so there is a focus on drawing in foreign investment, encouraging domestic investment, building up the infrastructure that the country needs to have a modern dynamic economy. And in that context, building on their comparative advantages, which are in things like computing and technology and electronics, and really positioning India as an alternative for countries and companies that are seeking to de-risk their supply chains from China. So in that context, that's where you get to the foreign policy aspect. And what Modi is really doing and sort of beating the drum on is that it's a little bit like making India great again. He's making India a great power. He's putting India at the forefront of international politics. They hosted the G20 last year. That was a big coming out party for them. And he gets the refracted glory, as it were, from India's growing role on the global stage. That means partly throwing off the idea, the last vestiges of sort of colonial dependence, where India has an autonomous and independent voice in the world. But it's also using that autonomous and independent voice in a way that is steering closer to the United States, because they view China as their major geostrategic threat and rival in the neighborhood. So that's where the de-risking comes in. That's where the advanced computing comes in. That's where the foreign direct investment comes in, because Modi is really keen to encourage the investment and companies looking to de-risk by putting their factories and their supply chains in India, in places where the economy meets up with national security concerns, like in advanced computing. So that's kind of the broad strokes of where he's trying to position the country. And Canada comes into that because of these, because of Canadian investments, because Canadian pension funds are major players in investments in India, particularly around infrastructure. And that's actually helped to keep a lid on tensions with China, with Canada, over this alleged assassination. The diplomatic fallout was real, but in some ways was choreographed. So you had the expulsion of some diplomats and the threatened expulsion of some others. But the there was a moment where the Indian side was not processing visas for certain Canadians coming over. That was affecting business travel. But that very quickly and quietly started to get sorted out. So India is keen to have the investment from Canada. The trade relationship is important, but as a geostrategic matter, Canada doesn't really matter that much to Delhi. Delhi is more concerned about what's going on in Washington, Tokyo, Canberra, and elsewhere. And to the extent that Canada fits into that calculation as a U.S. ally, as a member of the Five Eyes with Australia, the U.S., the U.K., and New Zealand, that's where India might think a little bit more about how to be constructive in relations with Canada, to the extent that if it's not, that can negatively affect its relations with the United States, which, as I said, has these economic as well as strategic implications for Delhi.
Okay, let's move on to Mexico. So the election in Mexico coming up in June, the incumbent president, AMLO, not running again, can't run again. So are there implications for Canada in the outcome of this race, you know, given Mexico's participation in our trade agreements and geographic proximity? What's the lay of the land there?
Definitely. I mean, Mexico is, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but definitely top five trading partner from Canada, for Canada, and possibly higher depending on when you look and how you rank them. You're right to say that AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, cannot run for another term, but his designated successor is pretty likely to prevail in the presidential election. Okay. What's interesting is that for a long period of time, there were a couple of parties that dominated Mexican politics. Don't need to go into the details exactly, but some listeners may remember Vicente Fox or Felipe Calderon from a decade or two ago. They represented the old establishment parties. And what's interesting about AMLO is that his party, Morena, is an insurgent party. And to this degree, actually, is something really interesting in common with Modi, which is that that party has established a sort of hegemony in Mexican politics akin to the BJP in India, as being a slightly populist outsider, which is now on the inside running the show. And they have a lot of legitimacy because they're seen not to have been part of the old establishment when things weren't working as well. So AMLO is very popular. I don't think if I'm remembering correctly, I don't think his approval rating has been below 50% ever, which, you know, Justin Trudeau would kill for, a lot of Democratic leaders would kill for. And so his designated successor, Claudia Sheinbaum, who's the former mayor of Mexico City, worked closely with AMLO in previous years and is not only likely to win, but therefore likely to continue in the same vein of policy as he has. So a lot of continuity in terms of policy. She, if I'm not mistaken, worked in a capacity under him on the environment. And one of the things that she wants to emphasize is opportunities in the green transition for Mexico, partly as a source for critical minerals, partly through automotive manufacturing, obviously in North America with the US and Canada. And in that vein is interested in pursuing deeper economic integration with North America, with the US and Canada. And so the other parties, Xochitl Galvez, I think I'm getting this correct, is the opposition party candidate representing a coalition of the old establishment parties, not likely to break through beyond their sort of core vote. And then there's another left-wing party also in the running, but really is more of an also-ran. Morena likely to capture the presidency with Sheinbaum, also likely to retain majorities in both houses of the Mexican Congress and pick up some more state governorships. So Morena is running Mexico these days, and the outlook is generally policy continuity. Although it's fair to say that Sheinbaum will be a little bit more technocratic, professional, focused maybe than AMLO, less populist, but pushing broadly in the same direction.
Are there any points of tension between the Canadian government and the Mexican government that are likely to persist into the next term?
Yes, immigration is the big one. Obviously, the thing that gets attention with immigration from Mexico is the southern border in the U.S. That's something we'll probably come on to a little bit later.
Yeah.
But that still affects Canada in two ways. One, because those flows of irregular or illegal, depending on the terminology you like, migrants, can flow up through the U.S. to the, you know, the famous Roxham Road in southern Quebec, people claiming asylum or otherwise coming into Canada and trying to circumvent immigration laws. Just in the last few days, I think the end of February, Global Affairs Canada reinstated visa requirements on certain Mexican travelers to Canada, mm-hmm. in part because of this. And that's been a long-running sort of bilateral irritant with Mexico. Mexico understandably wants more visa-free travel to Canada, but Canada is concerned about A, irregular migration, and B, the implications from the United States about a potential kind of backdoor there. So that's likely to persist, not as something that's going to blow up in anybody's face, but as an irritant in the relationship going forward. But that said, Canada and Mexico have a lot of interests in common. The biggest one being when they meet as two and three to the American one in a trilateral format, both have interests in keeping trade flowing north-south with the new United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, which is the successor to NAFTA. And Mexico, in certain respects, shares some of Canada's inclination towards ramping up integration, engagement with multilateral forums. And so there can be a good opportunity for Canada, both on the economic front, to sort of collaborate with Mexico on North American supply chain integration, and on the diplomatic level, where it could be a very good partner for Canada, which represents, you know, the developing world or the global South, but also has a foot in North America and has a sort of an outlook that Canada can find points of commonality with when it comes to things like multilateral engagement in the UN system or elsewhere.
Do Canada and Mexico have kind of their own relationship going on, or is it dependent on like this anchor of the U.S. economy? Like, do they kind of just talk through the U.S. is what I'm getting at?
No, that's a great question. I think it's fair to say that the relationship is not all that it might be, and that the U.S., because Mexico is a little bit of a mirror image for Canada in that the U.S. is so far and away its most important partner, that the focus is often there. And maybe you're not able to look up to the horizon and see, you know, just beyond the U.S. that there's this other partner. So I think it's a relationship, and Canada has, I have to say, probably a lot of these relationships that it hasn't and is not yet looking like it's going to reach its potential. But there's an opportunity there for a more interesting and more fruitful bilateral relationship if everybody can, you know, take their eye off the really important and shiny object in the room, which is the United States, and and work on some of these other things.
Okay, well, I do want to talk about the United States soon, but before we get to that, I want to get to Europe for a second. So Rishi Sunak, Prime Minister of the UK, says that they'll have an election sometime in the second half of this year. So my first question there is, are the Conservatives finally going to lose an election in the UK? Is this, are they finally done?
I would not rule anything out, but in all likelihood, yeah, they're done.
And maybe we can give some context to listeners too, just about like the Conservative foothold in the UK and like what that could, like what would a switching of power mean from like a policy perspective?
Yeah. So broad strokes in UK politics, the Conservatives win a lot of seats in the south of England, what is sometimes called Middle England, which is like your 905 equivalent in Toronto, right? It's the, it's that swing middle that can decide elections. And the Tories have had a lock on these English voters, particularly English voters. They, you know, they get a couple of seats in Northern Ireland, they get a few seats in Scotland. When Boris Johnson won his big majority back in what seems like eons ago in 2019, he picked up a ton of votes in the north of England that used to be Labour strongholds. And that gave the Tories, they've reinvented themselves multiple times. They've been in power for 14 years, but five prime ministers, two of whom won majority governments. There was a Theresa May minority in there. And there was the coalition even further further ago with David Cameron back in 2010 to 15. So the Tories are classic, the classic political chameleons who sort of change their colors to fit the circumstances. And they've held on for a really long time, in part because the Labour Party, after Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, veered really far to the left. Some listeners will remember Jeremy Corbyn, and he was kind of the boogeyman who the Tories were able to exploit for a long time. Middle England wasn't going to vote for Jeremy Corbyn, but they've now got Keir Starmer, who is a much more moderate, middle of the road. I think he's a former Crown prosecutor. He's steered the Labour Party back to the comfortable, more predictable center of the political spectrum. And this election, after all the ups and downs from austerity after the financial crisis, through the coalition, through the Tory majority that then gave the Brexit referendum, to leaving the EU and the Boris Johnson, through all of this sort of craziness in UK politics, the next election is shaping up as something quite refreshingly normal, where you have a center-left party and a center-right party, and they're going at it over economic issues. Migration's a big one too, but economic issues. So the UK has kind of steadied the ship politically. The question is whether they can steady it economically and what a Labour government would do when it comes in. So that's a very long, long-winded way to get to the crux of the question there, which is, well, what would Labour do? The big thing from a foreign policy or engagement with the world point of view is that they would continue what Rishi Sunak has been doing in steadying the ship in terms of right-sizing relations with the EU. Right? They're not going to, certainly not in a first government, they're not going to go back in to EU structures, but they're going to look for any opportunity they can in trade, in security, and just the general tenor of things to improve the relationship with Brussels and with European partners. Another thing that they'll likely do is try to the extent that they can, being hemmed in by low growth and fiscal challenges, is try to beef up where the Tories had been lacking a little bit, in their view, on green transition kind of spending. But already they've rolled back. They had promised, you know, they'll spend $28 billion over 5 years on green transition. They've rolled that back because of the fiscal position that the UK finds itself in. So big thing will be steady the financial ship, see if they can't get the economy going again. And to that degree, or sort of in that vein, the Labour Party has been doing a lot of work repairing relations with business and commercial organizations and chambers of commerce in the UK so that they're seen as a steadier pair of hands and can work constructively. So that's kind of the main thing, would be focused on steadying the ship economically at home and particularly the relationship with the European Union abroad.
Will Canada notice any difference between a Rishi Sunak government and a Keir Starmer government? Or is, in that respect at least, it's pretty much just continuity?
The casual observer won't see that much, honestly. You know, if you travel to London, you won't notice a difference. If you're a bit of a policy wonk or you've got business interests in the UK, you will see some differences, certainly, around the edges. And, you know, it will be a different flavor of government with different ideological and economic priorities. But from the relationship with Canada point of view, it's a little bit, we keep alluding to it, like the US, sometimes the relationship is so deep and so positive that whoever's in power on either side politically, it doesn't disrupt things that much. So the relationship with Canada through NATO, through Five Eyes, the diplomatic coordination that just happens on a working level all the time, that's not going to change. The UK is still surprisingly one of Canada's biggest trade partners. And in that area, there is work to be done rolling over the post-Brexit free trade arrangement with Canada. Those negotiations broke off a couple of months ago. Depending on who you ask, it was mostly the UK getting fed up with Canadian dairy protectionism, which is a long story.
That a tale as old as time.
People will know too much about. Maybe there's a chance for a reset there. But beyond that, Canada is, in all likelihood, it's going to ratify the UK's membership for the, always have to get my acronym here, CPTPP, which is the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. The UK is the first new country to join as part of its post-EU sort of venture out into free trade agreements with the rest of the world. That's going to keep working. Basically, relations are going to be good regardless. It's just, it'll be more about the tone. Certainly, as long as the Liberals are in power in Ottawa, they're going to get along with the Keir Starmer government really well. Labour might not be so friendly if there is a Pierre Poilievre conservative government in Ottawa. But again, that's more like, you know, are we really, really close friends politically? Or are we sort of family and, you know, we can have spats internal to the family a little bit? That relationship is very solid. And the big thing in either case will be, can they get this trade negotiation back on track?
I have a quick question on the potential of the relationship, because, like, I mean, any friend that, you know, you've known since childhood and, you know, the relationship is just so deep that it's almost unspoken and you can go years without, you know, interacting and all of a sudden you hang out and it's all fine. You can take advantage of that closeness and that relationship, or you can take it for granted, I should say. And so you talked a little bit about there being missed opportunities in different kind of places and different countries where Canada might, you know, be missing opportunities for closeness, for building relationships. Is there any opportunity with the UK that you see in the short term that maybe isn't being realized?
Yeah, that's a good question. Mostly on the diplomatic side. I mean, I think that the Liberals in Ottawa, compared to the Conservatives, do not have the instinctive friendliness for the Commonwealth or the Five Eyes in quite the same way. And that's where it does affect, you know, if the political stripes don't match, the relationship can be good, but not great. Because sometimes it, in diplomacy, it really is that chemistry between leaders that can get things over the line. If the bureaucrats are kind of stuck, but the two of them agree, we want this and we're going to make sure that we achieve it, that gets things moving. And the Conservatives in the UK just don't overlap all that easily with the Liberals in Canada, even though you know, the relationship is smooth and pretty seamless. It's maybe not as maybe not leaned on to the same degree that it could have. But more broadly, Canada's issue is like it needs to decide what it is that it needs to do in this new world. And there are two big opportunities, which are one, deepen those relationships with close partners who are sometimes taken for granted because as the world has changed and become more frankly, more dangerous, we really need to be aligned with those key partners who we can trust at a fundamental level. And that means countries like the UK. But at the other, on the other side of the ledger, you've got countries like India and Mexico and Indonesia and Vietnam and the rise of the global south, of the rebalancing of global power to the Indo-Pacific and away from the Atlantic and Europe. And that's going to challenge Canada to sort of stretch its diplomatic muscles a little bit and do some things and build some relationships that it's maybe not been as used to doing in the past.
Yeah, because we keep getting left out of stuff. Like a trade agreement is okay, but it's a bit worrying when you start getting left out of the security pact, isn't it?
Yeah, that may be a really good segue to the pressure that we're going to get from the U.S. eventually. But it is, you know, the Europeans are starting to spend more money on defense because of Russia. Our friends in the Indo-Pacific, like Australia and like Japan, even New Zealand with their new government, they're starting to spend more on defense because they're concerned about China. And the United States is pursuing a diplomatic and strategic policy where they're moving away from the old alliance structures, although those remain important, to create new, what Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor in Washington, has called a lattice work of relationships. It's just to say overlapping partnerships with different countries. And in that context, Japan, really important. South Korea, really important. Australia and India, really important. And Canada is not a member of AUKUS, which is the security alliance focused. The thing that gets the attention is these nuclear-powered submarines for Australia. But the thing that's really interesting and potentially the real takeaway from that agreement is cooperation on advanced technologies and their application in strategic and military affairs. And Canada is not a member of that, with the UK, Australia, and the US. It's not a member of the Quad, which is the quadrilateral security dialogue with the US, Australia, India, and Japan. And for a long time, I know Ottawa's just in the last 18 months come out with a new Indo-Pacific strategy. But our friends, you know, it's that horrible cliche, the world wants more Canada. Nobody really does. That's a thing that people just say in Ottawa. It's a very self-congratulatory thing that doesn't really reflect Canada's weight in the world these days. But some of the countries that really do want more Canada are Japan and Singapore and probably Australia to some degree. Canada's weight, South Korea for sure. Canada's been seen as having been missing in action in that part of the world. And the new strategy was a good step in that direction. But without concrete measures that are backed by funding, it's going to be hard to convince some of these countries to invite Ottawa to join their new clubs.
Mm. Okay, well, let's segue into the U.S. then. And barring any sort of 11th hour changes, it does seem like it's going to be a Biden-Trump rematch. And I do want to talk about the implications of each of those administrations and what they might mean mm-hmm. for Canada. But before we do that, are there any issues that people should be aware of that are going to come up in the Canada-US relationship regardless of who wins?
That defense thing that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. It may be a good cop, bad cop role-playing, but they're going to be delivering the same message. Canada just does not... That 2% of GDP defense spending target that NATO sets and that people talk about, that's supposed to be a minimum, and it was set in 2014. right? The world's changed a lot in 10 years, and not for the better when it comes to security and defense. So, you know, we've lived through a period of inflation. It may be that 3% is the new 2% when it comes to defense spending. Australia, again, Australia is a great comparison for Canada and not always flattering for Ottawa. Australia has just announced plans for its largest naval buildup since the Second World War. It is going to spend, I think it is currently, but it is definitely projected to spend above 2% within the decade. It is focused on upping its capability. Japan is going to spend 2%. They've never barely spent 1%. And European countries from Poland to the Baltic states to even Germany are upping their defense spending. And it's not that the defense spending as such is an end in itself. It's what do you do with those tools? And the risk for Ottawa is that the pressure is going to get turned up on them to put their money where their mouth is, regardless of which administration is in power in Washington. It's just going to be delivered in a slightly different tone of voice. The other point is that, which fits the good cop, bad cop kind of role play, both parties in the U.S. are pretty protectionist, which from a Canadian point of view is not great, because there's no more important interest for the government in Ottawa in its engagement with the world than keeping the border open to the free flow of goods, people, and capital. And the Biden administration has, because it is more instinctively accommodating and multilateral towards its partners and its allies and its friends, Canada got on the good side of some of those investment, the Inflation Reduction Act subsidies for green tech and that kind of thing for electric vehicles manufactured in North America. But both parties have protectionist instincts, and Ottawa will need to be, not just Ottawa, but Canadians and policymakers generally will need to be on the lookout for that, regardless of who wins.
I mean, okay, let's talk about Trump then, because that's just more interesting. But is there, if Trump wins, is there a risk of the USMCA? Maybe that's not the acronym we're using anymore. CUNFTA
is what
whatever.
I call it. Just
Is there a risk of that being reopened again, or is this a settled issue?
Nothing is settled with Trump. I think everything is a future potential point of leverage. The benefit, and from where we're sitting, let's just say, you know, as it stands right now, it is a coin flip. And if you were Joe Biden, it doesn't look as good as you want it to look, frankly, right? He's trailing in the head-to-head polls. He's trailing in the swing state polls, which is really where it's going to matter, right? It's like six states and tens of thousands of votes who are going to swing the election. He's trailing in those places. He's trailing when asked who's best to handle the issues that people care about, which is the economy, the cost of living, and immigration. And people are starting to be really worried about his age. And I mean, I would be worried about my stamina being president of the United States, and Joe Biden's 81, right? So not where you want to be.
No.
So the Trump prospect, he's likely to be officially the something, you know, I guess it's not official until the conventions, but today is Super Tuesday. It's likely that Nikki Haley drops out after tonight, and then Trump is the presumptive nominee, and it will be Trump versus Biden, barring any unforeseen moves on the Democrat side. And people need to get their heads around that is happening, and that Trump has a really good chance to win. If he does, the silver lining for Canada on USMCA is that's Trump's agreement.
Which would count for a lot with him, I feel.
He very pleased to trumpet his achievements. And that may play to Canada and Mexico's advantage when it comes up for review in 2026, if that's under a Trump presidency. There is a disincentive to attack an agreement that he himself negotiated, or his people, notably Robert Lighthizer, negotiated. That also, you know, as far as almost trade policy is an intricate thing, and it's there are experts and lawyers and people who know the ins and outs. But broadly speaking, it seems to be working pretty well. So the hope would be, I think, that there will be bumps in the road. There will be protectionist threats. There will be things you don't know are coming until they arrive. But I would be hoping from the Canadian point of view that the fact that USMCA was negotiated under Trump and he put that in the, you know, in the shop window as an achievement might go some way to protecting it.
Broadly, is the current Liberal government, or, I mean, I know this is a hypothetical, or the future, what could be a Conservative government, like, are either of them prepared for a Trump presidency?
It's hard to prepare. The benefit is that we've seen this movie before, right? I think a second Trump administration would be both less restrained and more competent, having been there once already. There's some unfinished business for a Trump administration, and also they'll hit the ground running in a way that they weren't able to before. So how do you prepare for that? The benefit from the Canadian point of view, this is structural and analytical and not, it's a bipartisan thing, which is if there is one thing that Canada can give lessons to the rest of the world on, it's managing relations with the United States. Hmm. Partly just because we, you know, I say we, I'm sitting here in Boston, but partly because Canada has to. It's the most important trade and strategic partner that Canada has. And it looms over everything else. But what Canada does exceptionally well is to understand that the way to shape U.S. policy to the extent that you can, to advocate for yourself in Washington, is less to go and have a meeting at the White House or a fancy dinner with the president, and more to know who to call in Congress, in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, and in the state capitals all around the country, the governor's mansions and the state legislatures, to remind those people that X number of jobs in their district depend on trade with Canada. That if you're hypothetically, let's say, the premier of British Columbia and the governor of Washington, that Washington's number one trading partner is Canada. And you can repeat that across the US. That's where the pressure points in the US system are. And that gets communicated up from the ground up, as it were, to the White House. And even chambers of commerce all around the country who can then lobby their local congressperson or their state legislatures or the governor. That's how to affect opinion in the U.S. political system. And it's something that Canada understands and executes very well. And that is regardless of the color of the political party, whether it's red, blue, or orange or something else in Ottawa, that is baked into the pie. And to be able to have the Premier of Ontario call up the Governor of Michigan when the White House is saying things about automotive tariffs, that's a huge advantage for Canada.
If you were advising the federal government, whichever stripe it may be after the next election, and Trump does win, what would you say are, you know, these are the big risks that you need to be paying attention to and preparing for right now?
It's hard to pick just one, isn't it? I'll phrase it this way. A potential Trump administration in the past, the Trump administration identified certain things that were kind of unsayable until they were said, like China is a strategic adversary, or we need our allies to spend more on defense because we're getting sick and tired of subsidizing their national security. That can mean that there are sudden shifts in the tectonic plates, right? Where you think, wow, there's an issue that has been festering for a while, but polite company kind of papers over it. when Trump or someone else like Trump, if there was such a person, comes in and says, hey, that's a problem, and all of a sudden everyone has to acknowledge it, that can mean that the ground under your feet shifts very suddenly. Mm-hmm. And whether that's on trade, whether that's on regulation, whether that's on security, like whether if Trump showed up in Moscow or Pyongyang or whatever to have a chat, all of a sudden facts on the ground change and smaller countries have to react and adapt. And for Canada, it's the double-edged sword of what is mostly an immense benefit of being the closest trade and strategic partner with the United States. On the other hand, Canada is highly dependent on and really leveraged on the US. So I'd be watching that trade. I mean, one of the things that a Trump administration would likely do, this will flip the thing a little bit, actually. Let's talk about an opportunity, but there's a really good chance that a Trump administration would begin to water down some of the provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act that throw a lot of money in terms of subsidies at green energy, at electric vehicles, this kind of thing. The likelihood is that no party is going to have a control of the whole government. But if it was a Trump administration, there's going to be some degree of watering down of the Inflation Reduction Act. And that in turn is actually surprisingly good for Canada, because one of the problems that Canada has is it can't match the money that the US is throwing in terms of subsidies. And so a reduction in those subsidies, while it's maybe not great for, you know, accelerating the green transition, it actually puts Canada in a more competitive situation, where if you're an investor looking at North America and you say, well, I could invest in Canada and build my plant there, or I could go to Tennessee and they'll throw a bunch more money at me, I guess I'll go to Tennessee. If that playing field is evened out to some degree, that actually helps Canada out from a competitiveness point of view. But as I said, the risks are going to require hypervigilance, and it's going to be a lot of places. But I think that trade is going to be one focus for a Trump administration. Still hypothetical, of course. Border security and immigration is going to be another, and international politics will become more volatile based on how the administration chooses to deal with countries like Russia, China, and others. So really, really challenging time to be a policymaker in Ottawa.
You want to ask any US questions?
That's okay. Yeah, no, that's okay. Okay. I could keep going for another 3 hours, but anyway.
There's a lot of material there. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Graham, before we let you go, I do want to ask about the political situation closer to home, and we don't need to get into detail on it, but what do you think the odds are of a federal election in Canada this year?
This year, under 50%.
Under 50%.
I think given what we saw a couple of weeks, time flies these days. A few days or a few weeks ago, where the Liberals and NDP announced an initial sort of framework agreement around national pharmacare. That's a big thing that the NDP said, we want the Liberals to deliver, to continue supporting them. Yeah. The fact that there's progress on that issue suggests that they're not likely to pull their support. And until the NDP pulls their support for Justin Trudeau, there isn't going to be an election. So I would be looking at this time next year for the 2025 budget, because that's going to be the government's last opportunity to put its, I used this phrase already, but to put its products in the shop window, show what it has to offer, and maybe from the government's point of view, get through 2024, which, you know, looks like a period of slow growth and interest rates that stay higher than we're used to, and people rolling over their mortgages during that period. You may not want to go to the polls if you're the Liberals. They might also take the chance that by this time next year, it's a Donald Trump presidency and that they could use that to their advantage. So I think all things being equal, we're probably looking at a 2025 election in Canada.
Okay, great. Well, Graham, will you come back on after the American elections and talk about what happened and what it means? I think that would be good.
Happy to come on anytime.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I thought that was a great overview of some of the electoral decisions that people are going to be making this year around the world. And interesting to get Graham's take on how Canada fits into that, or in some cases doesn't really fit into it for a variety of reasons. But what did you think?
Well, I think talking about politics is really fun. We should do it more often.
Yeah. Should we just do a politics podcast?
Maybe. We're so in this business bubble too, right? But it's just, it's so interesting just to think about just this patchwork of like leadership and countries and how they work together or don't work together and how, you know, the cooperation between governments like depend on two different elections going one way or, you know, I think in the case of when you look to kind of what's to come, I guess it's, you know, if there is a Trump presidency, would a conservative, you know, would a conservative government be better equipped for that? Would it be the other way around? These are really interesting things to think about. But I feel like I have a better grip on some of the most consequential, I think, elections, at least as it relates to Canada. And very interesting to hear Graham go into the specifics about how India might be thinking of us versus the UK and how all of these relationships kind of stand on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it made me think that we should do an episode sometime on more Canadian foreign policy and like why don't we have some more bilateral relationships with countries like Mexico or some of the other countries he mentioned, like South Korea and Japan. Like, you know, I don't know much about that and the details of why we've been left out of some of those agreements is interesting.
100%. That could have been an episode probably in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, immediately when Graham said that, you know, they're looking for people to, they should be looking for people to forge relationships with Japan. Mm. I thought of you immediately because you could go over.
Yeah.
And for listeners that don't know, last week we talked about, 2 weeks ago, we talked about how great Tokyo is of a city. So if they need a Canadian to go down there and forge relations.
Research.
Yeah.
I
you could
volunteer.
Put your hand up.
Yeah.
But you don't hear about this, I guess, so much in terms of, I don't know, this is going to sound so stupid, but like if I don't see like the MPs like on Twitter posting their trips to Australia or Japan or South Korea, I'm just assuming it's not happening.
No, I don't know if it's happening. I mean, assume someone's doing something, but that's what I mean. I have no idea how that works or it's just a different world. But yeah, interesting stuff there. And, you know, the opportunities that he talks about that might arise with a Trump administration also kind of interesting.
Very interesting. Interesting take. And also just to think, I mean, I know we've talked a little bit about defense, I think in the newsletter more so because we're talking about spending, but I think the emphasis on how big of a talking point that might be, not in the course of these elections, but as new leaders kind of come into the seat and as the dust settles and then countries start looking towards the future and think, okay, well, what is really important to me? And defense becomes one of those key discussion points and action points, I guess, too, how Canada might start feeling the pressure there.
I'm just looking it up right now. Apparently, we spend 1.29% of our GDP on defense.
Right, yeah.
So that would mean another $20 billion.
But I guess it's
in spending.
To Graham's point, though, it's not what you spend, it's also how you spend it.
And it sounds like they want us to just spend more, though. They want, it's like a very fixed number. Here's my question, though. Why do the Americans care about this?
About us spending more?
Yeah, they spend so much money on defense. Why does it matter if we spend another $20 billion?
Because they feel like they're writing blank checks, I guess.
So it's just like a petty thing?
Maybe, yeah.
It's like, you know, you can afford to cover dinner, but you want your friend to chip in or something?
That's exactly what it is.
Like, dumb.
If you can cover the bill.
I would be a terrible negotiator.
If you can cover the bill, if you can afford to cover the bill, I think this is your point that you should.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, they should.
I'm going to have a word with the White House.
Maybe. Okay. We can send them a letter, I'm sure. Right. An email.
We'll definitely have to have Graham back on after November to talk about whatever incoming happens. Administration we happen to get. But I think we can leave it there for now.
I think so.
Okay, well, this has been another episode of Free Lunch by the Peak. If you enjoyed this, you can find all of our past episodes by searching Free Lunch by the Peak wherever you get your podcasts. And please do take a moment to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I really appreciate that. And we will see you next week.